Welcome to the Prophet University audio series. Here are your hosts, Bill Kennard and Tom Grandy.
Welcome to the Prophet University audio series. I'm Bill Kennard, along with our company's founder, Tom Grandy. This month's program is titled Biscuits, Fleas, and Pump Handles. Tom, I suspect nearly all of our listeners are pretty familiar with Zig Ziglar. He was probably the best-known motivational speaker in the country, if not the world. I loved listening to this presentation, as Zig always is entertaining, no matter what the topic is that he's presenting on. This presentation has a rather odd title, as many of Zig Ziglar's presentations do. What are your thoughts on the presentation?
Bill, like yourself, I love listening to any presentation Zig Ziglar presents. Although he's been gone for many years, his presentations and content are timeless. The first thing that really caught my attention was when he said 97%, that's right, 97% of all Americans have never written their objectives or goals on paper. Wow, that's amazing. The other thing that jumped out was the fact that a presenter like ourselves needs to make his or her point at least 16 times before the listener remembers it. Guess what, Bill? I'm going to have to revise my presentation just a little bit to hit that goal.
Right? I guess I will too, Tom. You know, Zig Ziglar also made a rather, I thought, profound statement when he said that you become what you're around. He went on to explain that if you're around negative people, talking in negative words, that you will become negative yourself. Put another way, be careful who you associate with, as it'll dramatically affect your ability to reach your goals. This month's presenter is Zig Ziglar, and he really needs no introduction. He was the best-known presenter of his time. His books, presentations, and quotes have lived on well past his death, and I am confident they will continue to affect lives for many years to come. And now, with biscuits, fleas, and pump handles, here is Zig Ziglar with this month's Prophet University audio series presentation.
You can get everything in life you want if you'll just help enough other people get what they want. I came in on the plane last evening, which is the way I generally fly. Now, I was seated next to an old boy, and I couldn't help but notice he had his wedding band on this finger, the index finger of the left hand. I commented on it. I said, "Friend, you've got your wedding band on the wrong finger." And he said, "Yeah, I married the wrong woman." And I said, "Well, you know, a man makes a mistake, he's not stuck with it, isn't he?" He said, "Looks like I am." He said, "This is the seventh time I've been married to that woman." I said, "Seven times, same woman?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, how do you explain that?" And he said, "Well, it's easy." He said, "After every divorce, I get a little behind on alimony, and she just repossesses me." I'm glad to see so many girls here. You know, not only are girls capable of dressing an audience up so much, but, well, women are just so much more practical than men. Like this lady down home, this bum came up to her on the street and said, "Ma'am," said, "would you give me a dollar for a sandwich?" And she said, "Well, not until I've seen the sandwich." Now, you see, that's practical. like the two girls talking, one of them said, "Well, I didn't want to marry him for his money, but that is the only way I could get it." You see, now that's practical. And what I want to do is I want to be practical today. I believe if we're going to be practical, we got to set some definite objectives. Yale University, 1953. Graduating class, they did a survey on. They discovered that only 3% of the graduating seniors had definite, predetermined objectives. 20 years later, they did another survey of those seniors who had graduated. Of the 3% who had set those goals, had committed them to paper, who had said, "This I will do," who had made a commitment, the 3% had accomplished more than the 97% who had not written it down. Despite this fact, ladies and gentlemen, 97% of the American people have never committed their objectives to paper. They've never taken the time and written them down and said, "This I will do." We believe there are some very basic reasons why they have not. Number one, they've never been sold, or they've been told, but not sold. I'm going to sell you on why you gotta. And the second reason is nobody has ever showed them exactly how they can set those goals. We've got a plan for you. And the third reason is that many people have this fear. You see, if you say you're going to do something and then you don't do it, then you've been wrong at the top of your voice. Even if you don't share it with anybody, if you write it down and then you don't achieve it, then you in your mind have failed. And so a lot of people never go that other step. They never really commit it to paper, because then if they don't reach it, they can always say, well, I didn't really want to. That was the reason I didn't. Then there's that fourth reason, ladies and gentlemen, and that is that most people don't think they deserve a beautiful wife or a good husband. Most people don't think they deserve good kids or deserve to live in a big house or deserve to accomplish a lot of things. And because they don't think they deserve them, Evelyn, that's the reason they don't set those goals. But Evelyn, you know, I believe man was designed for accomplishment. I believe he's engineered for success. I believe he's endowed with the seeds of greatness. I believe God wants you to make it. I really do. I want to talk about one of the goals. I'm going to talk about money. As a matter of fact, I surprise a lot of people. I'm going to talk a lot about money. Some of my Christian friends there once in a while said, Zig, how do you reconcile all that talk about money with Christianity? And I just kind of grin and say, well, that's easy. You know, I think God made the diamonds for his folks, not Satan's bunch. Yeah. You know, the 23rd Psalm says, I'm going to live in his house forever. Now, you know, he's got the building materials of the universe to put it together. Don't you know that's going to be some kind of place? I don't believe he wants me in a chicken shack between here and there. Can't believe it. I want to talk about money. See, a lot of people don't understand it. They talk about cold, hard cash, and it's neither cold nor hard. It's soft and warm. It feels good. Beautifully colored. Go with whatever you got. I don't care what you wear, and it'll blend in with it. You know, not once has that redhead of mine ever said, honey, wait a minute, I got to go change clothes because what I'm wearing won't go with what you're carrying. I mean, it goes good. I don't know your experience with money, but you know, I've had it and I hadn't had it, and it's better to have it. I mean, it really is. And you know, I'm probably going to surprise when I say this. Did you know you can't get too much money? That's right. Now, if the money gets you, that's too much. See, if money ever becomes your God, you'll be a miserable human being for life. No way you can make it if you have money as your sole God. And the reason for that, you see, Solomon said, he who seeks silver will never be satisfied with silver. And we know that's true because in the last 2 years, there have been 5 billionaires to die. Somebody in Dallas said, I wonder how much money Howard Hughes really left. And somebody else said, he left it all. So you see, if somebody asks you how much money you're going to leave, you can simply say, same as Howard Hughes. And you'll be right, you see. But having said all that, let me start all over. You can get everything in life you want if you'll just help enough other people get what they want. Now, I don't care what your job is. See, if you're a salesman, you're selling a product that solves a problem, you sell enough products that solves enough problems, you're going to get what you want. Is this not true? And if you are a manager and you can train and enthuse and inspire and motivate your organization to be more productive, then they will get their rewards and you will be rewarded because you have helped your people get what they want. PMA rallies is in the same category. See, we want you to tell your friends and relatives, be with us in Birmingham and Salt Lake City and Chicago and wherever we're going. We want you to tell them to be there. And we know we've got a responsibility. Before you're going to say to your company people, go to the rally, we've got to do something for you. We've got to leave you with something. Is this not true? See, as a speaker, I can get everything in life I want if I'll just help you get what you want. You might say, well, Zig, what do you want? Well, I want to be invited back to Dayton. And I'll tell you now, it'll be a shame if I'm not. Because you see, my next talk is so much better than this one. But you see, I got sense enough to know that if I don't do good this time, there ain't going to be no next time. And that's what I'm saying to you. You see, if you do now what you're supposed to do, if you deliver, then you're going to be invited back. Whether you're a school teacher, a doctor, or a dentist, whether you travel for NCR all over the country as Ira Hayes does, regardless of what you do, if you do good today, you're going to be invited back tomorrow. I want to talk about goals, ladies and gentlemen, because we must have them. A number of years ago, Jean-Henri Fabre, the great French naturalist, conducted a series of experiments with some processionary caterpillars, so named because they follow each other in a procession. He lined them around a flower pot until they formed a continuous, never-ending circle. And they started going round and round, 24 hours a day, 7 days they did this, night and day, until they literally dropped dead of starvation and exhaustion. Now, in the center of the flower pot, Fabre had placed some pine needles, which is the food of the processionary caterpillars. With an abundance of food less than 3 inches away, they starved to death because they confused activity with accomplishment. See, there are people in the Dayton area today who, despite the fact that our economy is booming and many people in their own organization are doing so enormously well, they never really accomplish much because they confuse activity with accomplishment. They have no objectives in life. You see, we see people all the time when they are working, their minds are saying, gee, I ought to be home with the family. And then when they're home with the family, they say, gee, I ought to be back out working. So when they're working, their mind's at home. And when they're at home, their mind is back out on the job. They're never anywhere. They're going against themselves. People complain about lack of time. It's not lack of time that's the problem. It's the lack of direction. Most people are what I call wandering generalities, and you won't make it as a wandering generality. You've got to become a meaningful specific. You probably don't recognize the name of Howard Hill, but he's the greatest archer that ever lived. He killed a Cape buffalo with a bow and arrow. He killed a Bengal tiger with a bow and arrow. As a youngster, I've seen Howard Hill from 50 feet. I've seen him split the bullseye dead center and then take the next arrow and literally split the first one. Now, I've never shot a bow and arrow than my son's child's bow and arrow. But I could hit the bullseye more consistently than Howard Hill could have hit it the best day he ever lived. And I'll say it without batting an eyelash. I could do it. Provided, of course, you blindfolded Howard Hill. You know, and turn him around a time or two so he wouldn't know which way he was heading. You might say, Ziegler, that's the silliest thing I've ever heard. How could a man hit a target he could not see? That's a good question. Here's another one. How can you hit a target which you do not have? Have you got one? Are you a wandering generality or are you a meaningful specific? You see, ladies and gentlemen, that's what most people go through life as, meaningful specific. They're gonna go to work tomorrow because that's where they were yesterday. And if you're going to go to work tomorrow because you did yesterday, that means that tomorrow you won't be as good as you were yesterday because you're 2 days older and no closer to a goal which you do not have. I started writing my book about 4 years ago, and as you probably suspect, I highly recommend it. As a matter of fact, you're considered underprivileged until you have read it. As I wrote this book, you know, I put down some words. I put, you can go where you want to go. You can do what you want to do. You can be like you want to be. And as I wrote those words, I got to fess up. I held it out there and said, now, Ziegler, that's pretty good. You know, matter of fact, I got to talking to myself, which is perfectly all right. It's all right even to answer. But if you ever catch yourself saying, huh? To the answer, you got a problem. Well, I caught myself saying, huh, to the answer, because you see, as I held the book out, I had to hold it way out because there was a 41-inch waistline between me and the book and 202 pounds of Ziegler. And the thought occurred to me, you see, that if I was going to go around this country making speeches saying you could be like you want to be, if I was going to put that in writing, I could imagine one of these days some dude is going to come up to me and stick his finger right in that 41-inch waistline and say, Ziegler, you believe what you write? And I was going to say, man, yeah. Then I was afraid they might say, do you believe it all? As he kind of wiggled that finger in my tummy, you know. And then I was going to say, well, you know, us authors, we do take a little literary license every once in a while. In other words, Ziegler, you lied about it, huh? Man, don't call me no liar. Folks don't like liars. Well, you at least a hypocrite. Don't call me no hypocrite. People don't like hypocrites. You're not going to believe this, but there are even some people who don't go to church because it's a bunch of hypocrites down there. I knew you wouldn't believe it. Of course, I always tell those folks, friend, if a hypocrite is standing between you and God, that just means that the hypocrite is a little closer to God than you are. So I don't believe I'd use that one anymore. You know, it's kind of like a lot of folks say, well, I'd read the Bible, but I just don't understand it. Well, I don't think it's the part they don't understand that bothers them. Because, you know, God speaks pretty clearly in His Bible. I bet you noticed He didn't call them the 10 suggestions. I mean, you know, it's pretty clear when you begin to analyze it in it. It sure is. It's there. I advise you to read it. Not only will it relieve pressure now, but tell you the truth, it'll keep the heat off of you later. You know? So, you know, I was faced with a decision. You know, Ziegler, if you're going to write books like that, if you're going to say things like that, then what you got to do is you got to do something about you. Then my boy was 8 years old, you know, and I think every father ought to be able to whip his children until they're at least 12. And the rate I was going, I wasn't even going to be able to catch mine, much less whip him. And then that redhead of mine, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. She kept telling me to hold my stomach in, and I already was. So I knew I had to do something, so I went down to Cooper's clinic. Now, Cooper wrote the book Aerobics. When you see people out jogging, you know, that means that Dr. Kenneth Cooper had his influence. Well, I went down for the examination. It's a 5-hour examination, and the first thing they did was took 2 quarts of my blood. Well, it looked like 2 quarts. I tell you, they filled so many vials, I thought they were opening a branch of the blood bank right there. And then they dunked me in a tank of water 3 times, completely submerged me, and the purpose of that is to determine the percentage of body fat that you have. When they got through, they told me I was 23.9% pure lard. And then they put me on a treadmill, you know, and on the treadmill you walk and walk and walk and walk, and the further you can walk, the better your health is. Well, the worst possible physical condition is horrible. Well, the nurse was sitting over there, you know, had her monitor going, and I was wired for sound and had my heart and my blood pressure. They were checking all those good things, my pulse, you know. And I was determined as I looked at it. I was determined I was going to get out of horrible into just awful. Now, I made it. I made it by 4 seconds. And finally, they got through, you know, and the young doctor called me in, Dr. Martin, beautiful young doctor, skinny, runs in the Boston Marathon, does the good things, you know, optimistic kind of a guy. You know, an optimist is a fellow when he wears his shoes out, just figures he's back on his feet, and that's the kind of guy he was. Oh, he was motivated. He called me in, big smile on his face. He said, Mr. Ziegler, we've run the figures through the computer. We've analyzed them completely and thoroughly. We know they're accurate, and you're going to be delighted to know that you are not overweight. However, he said, according to the computer, you are exactly 5 1/2 inches too short. And I said, well, Doc, that's pretty bad, isn't it? He said, no. He said, actually, you're in remarkably good physical condition for a 66-year-old. And I said, Doc, I'm 46. He said, you're in awful shape. He said, matter of fact, if you were a building, I'd condemn you. And I said, well, Doc, what can I do? And he whipped out a sheet of paper thicker than my book, and he started telling me what I could do. And by the time he got through, I was kind of like the little boy that asked his daddy a question. And his daddy said, well, son, why don't you just ask your mother? The little boy said, well, Daddy, I just didn't want to know that much about it. The boys generally like that one better. But anyhow, I got home. My redhead said, well, I suppose you're going to be out running all over the neighborhood. And I said, yes. Well, she said, if I'm going to have a 46-year-old fat boy running all over the place, I'm going to get you looking just as good as I can. So she went down to the store and bought me some fancy running shirts and shorts, and I'd gotten a pair of shoes the doctor had recommended. Oh, and I did something that's kind of ugly. But I hadn't read Ann Landers at the time, you know, and I'll use that as my excuse, although I really knew better. You know, Ann says you should not steal pages out of other folks' magazines. And there was an advertisement in the doctor's magazine for jockey shorts. Now, I don't know if you folks in Dayton read the jockey short ads or not. But if you don't read them, the next time you see one, you ought to at least look at the picture. You'll find out in a hurry, they don't put jockey shorts on fat boys. At least they don't have a good year. So I took that picture, I hung it up in my bathroom, and I said, now there's my hero. That's the way I'm going to be one of these days. And the next morning, that alarm clock sounded off, you know, and I hopped out of bed, and I slipped on that fancy running outfit, and I hit that front door, and I ran a block. All by myself. Next day, I did better, though. I ran a block in a mailbox. And then a block in two mailboxes, then a block in three, and a block in four, and a block in five. One day I ran all the way around the block, came back in, woke the whole family up and said, guess what Dad has done? One day I ran a half a mile, then I ran a mile, then I ran a mile and a half, then ran 2 miles. Started doing the sit-ups, only 8 the first day, then 10, then 20, then 40, then 80, then 120. Started doing the push-ups, only 6 the first day, then 8, then 10, then 20, then 30, then 40. And today I do the GI push-up, meaning you push yourself up and slap your hands while you're in the air. And the weight came down from 202 to 165. And the waistline dropped from 41 to 34. And you probably wonder, why do I go all to all of this length to tell you about the little story? Am I trying to get you to lose weight? No, emphatically not. There's several reasons I'm doing it. First of all, I'm really hitchhiking on what Dr. Shuler and Mr. Robert and Cabot said and Mary Kay. And that is, in so many words, each of us is saying the same thing, that if we're going to have a complete success, we've got to have a complete individual. You got to be sound physically and spiritually and mentally. You see, if you make $1 million and lose your health in the process, you're not successful. If you go all the way to the top of the ladder but alienate your family along the way, you are not successful. I just believe that you can get them all. I don't know how you feel about it, but that's the way I feel. If you want them all, there are a lot of people who really don't care to be wealthy. Of course, most of the folks that tell me they don't want to make money, I believe they lie about other things too. I believe that we can get all of these if we build on that right foundation. I'm talking about physical part now because it's going to, as you shall see, involve the physical, the mental, and the spiritual, which enables us to get all of those things. A lot of my friends say, well, he's probably been dieting religiously, which, now that is partially true because I did quit eating in church, you know. And as you probably already are beginning to suspect, I'm like a cross-eyed discus thrower. I don't set any records, but I do keep the crowd alert. And you know, I think that's important. I tried the 30-day diet and lost a month. But the only dieting advice I'm going to give you is simply this. Stay away from cottage cheese. Most fattening food in existence. Now, understand I have no valid scientific data to establish this, but I'm convinced of it beyond any reasonable doubt. Cottage cheese is the most fattening food in existence. And I say that because I've noticed that don't nothing but fat folks eat the stuff. You know? Then why do I tell you about this thing that we call objectives? Why do I tell so much about losing weight? I tell you because it involves every single principle of goal setting, all of them. But I urge you, don't let me talk you into going on a diet to lose weight. It's got to be your objective. First of all, ladies and gentlemen, you cannot reach somebody else's goal without paying another price for it. That's the first thing. The goal was mine. My wife did not talk me into losing weight. My doctor did not talk me into losing weight. It was my decision. Why did I decide? I decided because of this thing called credibility. You see, I don't know how you feel about it, But if I write a book that says you can be like you want to be, and then I come waddling out at 202 pounds, I've got an idea that some credibility is lost. And you would begin to think, I wonder what else the guy lies about. If I stand in front of you and acknowledge Jesus Christ as Lord, and then tell you a dirty joke, my total credibility, you see, is absolutely destroyed. What you've got to do is you've got to live a consistent life, because you cannot be one kind of a person and enjoy another kind of success. People talk about breaking laws. You break no laws. You step out of a 20-story building, you don't break the law of gravity. You confirm it. And that's all any of us do. I was so intrigued with the response that Mr. Stone made when somebody says, if you really want something, and Mr. Stone said, tie on to the greatest source of power of all. And that from a man who reputedly is worth over a third of $1 billion. That was spelled with a B. That's right. I tell the story of losing the weight, though, because it involves all of the principles. First of all, it was mine. Second, my credibility was at stake. Third, it was a big goal. You know, 37 pounds. The doctor didn't say to me, Ziggy, you ought to lose some weight. He said, man, you got to lose 37 pounds. That's a big goal. If you don't remember anything else, remember this. In order for a goal to be effective, it must affect change. One of my good buddies came up to see me a little early. He said, man, he said, you have slimmed down. I said, uh-huh. You know, he could tell a difference. He could tell a difference. And the change had taken place. You see, if this rally, which really is a rally that gets so many people involved, and the thing you will discover as you go about your lives tomorrow, you will see so many people who will have a different attitude, because when you put this many PMA people together, things have got to happen. Because really, when you start putting this much activity together and many people saying the good things, then, oh, some good things begin to happen. I loved what Mr. Stone was saying there when he said your logic is not going to change an action, but an action will change your feeling. And when you really become convinced that you can do things, then, of course, you will. Oh, I tell the story because the 37 pounds was a big goal, and it made a difference. And the second thing about the goal was it was a long-range goal, although as a practical matter, it was more of an intermediate goal. Let me tell you why I said it as I did. I tried to get three publishers to publish this book, and they said, Ziegler, we don't think it'll sell. With the fourth printing, they said, hey, you know, I think that book will sell. But anyhow, they wouldn't publish it. I knew the book would sell. And this involves another principle they call commitment. When I ordered my first printing, I ordered 25,000 copies. Now, you know, I could have ordered 2,000 or 5,000, but if you believe something, and what Dr. Shuler was saying is so true. Oh, the beautiful story of the fish. We might not throw the fish back because he doesn't fit a 10-inch pan, but how many of us throw the big ideas back and grasp to the little ones where there's no danger involved? We say, I know I can do this, so just give me the little one. I want a little bite out of life. And that's really what we're saying, is it not? I had a long-range goal. I knew I was going to the printer in exactly 10 months. My long-range goal was that. My wife and I get aboard. Incidentally, she, as you know, is with me. We are celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary. Don't you stand up, sweetheart. Hey. Now, I hear a little murmuring, so let me hasten to add, I didn't say we've been married 50 years. See, we've only been married a little over 30 years, but we've heard so much about the 50th wedding anniversary that we just decided to go ahead and celebrate it early. While we were still young enough to really make it a celebration, and I'm here to tell you that's some more celebration. As a matter of fact, we're going to repeat it next year. I advise it highly for everyone. Incidentally, this is probably not the right time to do it, but how many of you would like to see me on the Johnny Carson Show next Thursday night? Would you hold up your hand? Well, I saw at least half of the hands go up. If you'll write him in a big hurry. I'm also available Wednesday night and Friday night also. Okay. You got to have a long-range goal. That's what this involved. I was going to lose that 37 pounds in 10 months. See, we get aboard that airplane tomorrow going to St. Louis. When we leave Dayton going to St. Louis, we will be going directly to St. Louis, Missouri for about 20 minutes. And then we'll no longer be going to St. Louis because, you see, the direction of the wind will change. The velocity will change. The curvature of the earth will affect the flight. The gravitational pull of the earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars will pull us off course. So the captain of the aircraft will turn it around and come back to Dayton and land and start over. Right? What'll he do? He'll make a slight adjustment, will he not? He simply will plan to make that slight change. And, you know, in the game of life, that's what we need to do with a long-range goal. When little things come up that necessitate change, they simply necessitate the change of direction and not the change of goal. He's going to change that direction. And the reason that's so important is you've got a little rule that says you go as far as you can see, and when you get there, you'll be able to see further. See, I looked at that 37 pounds, I divided by 10, it came out 3 7/10 pounds. And I got excited. I knew all I had to do was lose 3 7/10 pounds a month. Man alive, I really got motivated because anybody on the face of this earth can lose 3 7/10 pounds a month. I was confident I could do it. As a matter of fact, I was so confident I could do it that I didn't even bother to get started the first 28 days. Again, your speakers have said it, each one of them. You got to do something, and you got to do it now. When you leave this evening, if you were to come to each one of us and you were to say to us individually or as a group, Don, I got a lot out of it. Or Mr. Stone, I got a lot out of it. Or Dr. Shuler, I got a lot out of it. Or Mr. Robert, I got a lot out of it. We'll all smile. If you come up and say, I enjoyed it, we'll all smile. But to be honest, we'll be standing there expecting considerably more. See, all you've said so far, if you enjoyed it and got a lot out of it, is you've experienced a good warm feeling, which you can also get by taking a bath. But if you come up to us and say, I enjoyed it, I got a lot out of it, and here is what I am going to do, then that's the purpose of PMA. Not to come in to entertain you. We simply try to make it enjoyable so that you will absorb and stay and get more out of it. But the whole purpose is to get you to do something. And so as I looked at that, the 3 7/10 pounds that I knew I had to lose every month, I did not get started those first 28 days. It's somewhat like the story that took place when I was a boy down in Yazoo City, Mississippi. That's where I was raised. As a matter of curiosity, how many of you folks have never been to Yazoo City? Could I see your hands? Okay, that's good. Now, I want you to understand there are a lot of people going around the country today claiming they're from Yazoo City just to impress folks, but I really am. Yazoo is one of those exciting places. About once a month, the train comes through town, and you know, which doesn't sound like excitement until I explain we don't have any tracks there, and then you know, that changes the picture. Not a big place. We don't even have a village drunk. We share with a little community next to us. Main Street runs through a car wash. We don't have a zip code. We just have a period. I mean, you know, it's one of those places. But when I was a boy in Yazoo City, we lived next door to some rich folks. And I know they were rich because they not only had a cook, but the cook had something to cook. And I was over there for lunch one day, as I tried to be most every day. And don't misunderstand this. Now, we had plenty to eat in my house, even though it was a depression. I know we had plenty because when I passed my plate for seconds, they'd always tell me, no, you've had plenty. So I know we had plenty. The cook brought the biscuits out, you see, and the biscuits were no thicker than this tuet. And I looked at it for a moment, you know, and I said, Maud, what in the world happened to your biscuits? And she reared back and gave that big old tummy lap and said, well, I'll tell you about those biscuits. She said, they squatted to rise. But she said they just got cooked in the squat. You know anybody that gets cooked in the squat? You know anybody that's going to do something? Just as soon as the kids get out of school, man, I'm really going to hit it. Then the kids get out of school, they say, well, you know, I didn't realize it, but the kids are underfoot all the time. Now I don't have time to do anything. Wait till the kids get back in school. Then they get back in school, they say, well, you know, we got a winning football team this year. Wait till after the football season is over. Then I'm really going to get after that, the football season, and say, well, you know, now it's Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. And wait till after that's over. Then I'm really going to get after that. After that's over with, they say, well, you know, the weather is so bad. And hasn't this been the worst year we have ever had? And wait till the weather lets up just a little bit, then I'm really going to get after it. And when the weather lights up, they say, well, you know, it's so close to Easter. Wait till after the holidays, then I'll do it. After that, they say, well, you know, the kids are out for school for spring holidays. Wait till after this is over. Then after that, they say, well, you know, first good weather we've had, I want to play a little golf, I want to go fishing. Wait till after that, then I'll really get after it. After that, they say, well, you know, it's almost time for the kids to get out of school. Wait till the kids get out of school. Then I'll really be ready to go. But you see, that's where we started, isn't it? If you wait till Aunt Matilda moves out, or John gets on the day shift, or the prime rate drops a point, or we change administrations, or the energy policy is installed, if you wait until external conditions change before you make an internal move, my brothers and sisters, you're going to get cooked in the squat. So you start from where you are with what you've got, with a full realization that what you have got is plenty good to get whatever it is that you really want. I broke the goal down to the other step. I broke it down on a daily basis. I discovered that all I had to do was lose 1 9-tenths ounces a day. And in 10 months' time, I would have reached my objective. You see, ladies and gentlemen, that's the thing that's so critically important. When you break it down and start doing something about it. Because when you get off those first pounds, the psychologists call this accomplishment feedback. The minute I got under 200 pounds, there was a milestone. Then I got under 195, my enthusiasm grew. Got it to 190, it grew some more. Got to 185, and some of my friends started saying, hey, Zig, aren't you losing a little weight there, friend? Oh, I tell you, I did. A lot of my friends said, now, Zig, I understand you got up and ran lots in the morning. I said, yep. Tell me the truth now, Zig. I want you to tell me the truth now. How did you feel about getting up in the morning? Did you really enjoy it? You want me to tell you the truth, don't you? I hated it. I hated it. How many of you have ever seen a living, breathing martyr? You're looking at one. You know, for years I've gone all over this country saying you got to pay the price. So I could put a strain in my voice and a pained expression on my face that would bring tears to the eyes of all but the very strongest. As I said, you got to pay the price, and what a bunch of baloney that is. And yet there was a certain involvement. You know, Keith, when that alarm clock would sound off in the morning, you know, I'd reach over and I'd shut it off, and I'd think to myself, Ziegler, what is a 46-year-old fat boy doing getting up running all over the neighborhood? Your buddies are sound asleep in bed. What are you trying to prove? Then I'd look down at that 41-inch waistline, and I'd say, Ziegler, do you want to be like you, or do you want to be like the guy in the jockey shorts? Well, I didn't want to be like me. So out of the bed I'd get, you know, and I'd put on that running outfit and I'd hit the front door. But I'll tell you, just because I was doing it, that didn't mean I had to like it. Not a bit. I'd start running. I'd say, I don't know what I'm trying to prove. Out here killing myself. My buddy's sound asleep. I don't know what but I said I was going to do it, and I'm going to do it. Oh, I hated it. And don't you think for one minute I didn't tell everybody I came in contact with about this enormous sacrifice I was making, getting up early in the morning, running in nights in some of the cities where I was scared to death. That's when I ran my fastest, as a matter of fact. I run in the snow of Winnipeg, Canada. I run in the sands of Acapulco. I ran in the orange groves of Florida, the rain of Minneapolis. And then one day, ladies and gentlemen, I was running in Portland, Oregon, Portland State University. I'll never forget it. beautiful day, about 75, 80 degrees. Kids were laying out on the campus on their blankets. Some of them were reading, some were studying, some were snoozing, some were courting. Beautiful day, and here comes old Ziegler, sweat running down my back, sweat running down my legs, you know. And you know, as I ran past those kids laying there, all of a sudden it dawned on me for the first time, I was having the time of my life. Finally, after several months of taking the actions, I acquired the feeling. Today, at age 50, I can outrun 98% of the college kids of America on a 2-mile run. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me as I was running that I was no longer paying the price. It occurred to me that I was thoroughly enjoying the price. Today, at age 50, I'm stronger than I was at age 25. I'm in better physical condition in every department than I was in. You talk to me about paying the price, and I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, you pay the price for poor health. You enjoy the price of good health. It was never more evident when I was within 7 pounds of my goal. I was in Dallas, my gallbladder ruptured, and of course you doctors will understand that that had nothing to do with the fact that I was running. 4 days it took them before they finally discovered my problem. For 4 days I hurt more than I've hurt the rest of my life combined. Finally, when they got in there, I was so filled with poison that an abscess had formed under my liver. The doctor said, I'm lucky. I know, of course, that 9 months earlier, God, knowing the time schedule in advance, had prepared me for the ordeal that my body had to undergo. I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, you don't pay the price for good health. You pay the price for poor health. You enjoy the price of good health. I'm going to tell you, girls, you don't pay the price for success. You pay the price for failure. I'm going to say you enjoy the price of success. I'm going to say you don't pay the price for a good marriage. I'm going to say that you enjoy the price of a good marriage. What I'm really saying is that if we analyze what is the difference between failure and success, between accomplishment and not doing it, I'm saying that the rewards are so enormous that if you are willing to temporarily forego pleasure, which is entirely different from happiness, that you will ultimately have that tremendous enjoyment that goes with living the full life. A lot of people say, Zig, how do you reach those goals? Well, if you're going to reach your goal, ladies and gentlemen, obviously you've got to know how to train fleas, because if you don't know how to train fleas, you can't reach your goals. And I know you heard the one about the two fleas at the bottom of the hill, and one of them says, well, do we walk or take a dog? You train fleas by putting them in a jar, and fleas will jump. They'll jump up and hit the top over and 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 over. You watch those fleas jump a long time, then all of a sudden you'll notice that even though they continue to jump, they're no longer hitting the top. Then it's a matter of record. You can literally take the top off, and even though the fleas will jump and jump and jump and jump, they cannot jump out. And the reason they cannot jump out is because they've conditioned themselves to jump just so high. And once they've conditioned themselves to jump just so high, that's all there is. There ain't no more. And man is the same way. You see, we live in a world, ladies and gentlemen, of negativisms. We live in a world of stinking thinking. We are afflicted with a disease called hardening of the attitudes. And that's the reason that here at PMA, we give that little checkup from the neck up to eliminate some of that stinking thinking. You see, let me give you a concrete example of what I'm talking about. For years, athletes tried to run a mile in less than 4 minutes, but they could not. Because, you see, the doctor had said your heart won't take it. The coach had said, man, no way can you do it. And so the athlete would toe the line and say, I'm going to do it. But that deep little voice inside would say, man, who you think you're kidding? Me and you both know that that you can't do it. And you see, that negative influence had had its effect. Nobody could run a mile until Roger Bannister came along. He broke the barrier. And the moment he broke the barrier, athletes the world over realized that it was not an unbreakable barrier. 6 weeks later, Landy of Australia did it. Since that date, over 500 men, eight of them, won race. Baton Rouge, Louisiana, June 1974 NCAA track meet. One guy, 36 years old, broke the barrier, ran the mile in less than 4 minutes. In case you're missing the point, a flea trainer is a person who's driven from within. A flea trainer is a person who jumps out of the jar. A flea trainer is a person who understands that you can get everything in life that you want if you'll just help enough other people get what they want. Flea trainer doesn't tell others where to get off. They show them how to get on. A flea trainer doesn't try to see through people. A flea trainer sees people through. You see, a flea trainer is an unusual individual. They've got that right mental attitude. They realize that they've got to be with and around people. And the tragedy is, you see, that we unfortunately live in a negative world. Overweight person, for example, sits down at the table and says, "Everything I eat turns to fat." That's negative. Mother sends a child off school and says, "Don't get run over." That's negative. Little boy comes home and says, "Dad, I'm afraid I flunked the arithmetic test." His dad said, "Don't worry about it, son. You come by it honestly. I never could learn the stuff either." That's negative. You have a wreck out on the highway and somebody says, "Call the wrecker." You done had the wreck. What you need now is a tow truck. But you see, we live in a negative world. The weatherman comes on and says, "We got a 60% chance of rain." Why doesn't a dirty dog tell me we got a 40% chance of sunshine? He says, partly cloudy instead of mostly fair. Mother gets up, you know, a housewife, looks around the house and says, "Boy, I'll never get this mess cleaned up." Negative. Ask somebody. Of course, this one lady down home, bless her heart now, she should have been negative. I mean, she is so bad, good housekeeping canceled her subscription. I mean, you know, it is one of those. But her husband's better off than this other old boy down home. I mean, his wife was so fastidious that he got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. When he came back, she had the bed made. Now, you know, that's overdoing it. But you see, we live essentially in a negative world. And what we got to do is we got to associate with positive people because you become part of what you're around. 2/3 of the medical students acquire the symptoms of the disease they study. Want a good case of the flu? Find somebody that's got it. They'll give it to you. Want stinking thinking? Get around people that's got stinking thinking. They'll share it with you. You become part of what you're around. Classic case. You can take a southern boy and send him up north, and in a matter of months, they'll pick up an accent. You've noticed it. Or you can take a northern boy or girl and send them down south, and in a matter of months, we'll have them talking normally. You become part of what you are around. Classic case, and this has been blowing educators' minds ever since it came out. In July 1976, Success Unlimited magazine, and if you're not taking it, you owe it to you to do so. This magazine told the story. Now, undoubtedly, we'll pronounce this incorrectly, but in the kibbutz in Israel, which is a self-contained unit, they had a large number of Oriental Jews to come. The children of those Jews, they had their evaluation. The average IQ was 85. They had a large number of European Jews to come to the kibbutz. And the average IQ of the European Jewish children was 105. Proving, you see, that the European Jews are smarter than the Oriental Jews. Or does it? Now, what happened in the kibbutz is a classic case of what I'm talking about. You see, in an environment that was positive, where directions were firm, where motivation was intense, where dedication was total, where they knew where they were going, where they wanted to accomplish things in their life, in a matter of months, the IQs of the Oriental Jewish children and the European Jewish children was the same thing. It was 115. You see, you become part of what you are around. And so if you're in a negative environment, how do you change that environment? Were you impressed with the fact that Mr. Stone keeps talking about all of the books he's reading? Do you think this man has trouble with stinking thinking? Were you impressed with the fact that Calvin Robert keeps talking about the books he's read, and Dr. Shuler and Don Hudson about all the books they've read and the tapes they have listened to? Cavett mentioned the astronauts. Did you know that when they were going to the moon and back, they were listening to motivational recordings? Did you know that when they were on the space platform going round and round and round, that that's what they were doing? Why they were doing it? They were doing it, ladies and gentlemen, because we know. How many of you, for example, when you leave here today, would like to maintain the feeling that you've got right now? Would you hold your hand up, please? Did you know that with the use of cassette recordings, that you can take this feeling with you, and all you got to do is press a button and you can feed that mind right there? I say to people over and over and over, we've got two series, sell for $100. Including the book. The $100 won't affect your standard of living, but the messages will change your life. Because what you do is you deliberately feed into your mind a series over and over and over and over about what happens and what can happen. You take the feeling with you, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I'm saying. I've never known a self-made millionaire in the world of selling who did not have and use motivational recordings every day of his life. It takes 16 listenings to get the message. 16 hearings. For example, I've been talking now about 49 minutes. And since I've been talking, although I do everything humanly possible to hold your attention, I turn this way some because I'm making them look at me from the rear. And they've got to change their view. I walk over here because it does the same thing to you. I squat down like this. I will stand up like this. Every 7 to 9 minutes, you can set your watch. I'm going to lay a funny on you. And every time I do, you know what happens? I see 50 or 100 people in the audience turn to somebody and say, "What do you say?" You know why? Even though as a professional speaker, I do everything I know to do to hold your attention. You see, I can only speak at about 280 words a minute with gust up to about 550. But you see, your mind functions at least 10 times that fast. And between those words, you're taking side trips. You go to the men's room or the ladies' room. You're looking in on kids. You've thought about, you know, a prospect you need to see tomorrow. You've wondered where Charlie is. That's the dude that ought to be down here right now. Where's Charlie? The net result is you miss a connecting link. And when you got a chance to hear it over and over and over, then the message is multiplied time and time again. I plead guilty, ladies and gentlemen. I've heard Dr. Shuler talk about catching that 10-inch fish. Today was the first time I heard him say, "We do the same thing because we throw back the big ideas." And I pride myself on being a good listener. But I picked up something brand new from an old story because I heard it again and again and again. You want to reach your goals, ladies and gentlemen? Then you got to remember the story of Houdini. You know, Houdini was a master magician, master locksmith. He made the boast that he could get out of any jail cell in the world if you would just let him walk in that jail cell with his street clothes on. He said, "I'll be out of there in an hour, no problem." A small town in the British Isles built a new jail. They issued the challenge. Houdini accepted. The day came. There was a lot of fanfare. The drums were beating. The bugles were blowing. Houdini rode triumphantly into town, strode into the jail cell. They closed the door behind him, and he took off his coat. Secreted in his belt, there was a 10-inch piece of steel. Very tough, very flexible, very durable, and he went to work. End of 30 minutes, that confident expression had disappeared. End of an hour, he was bathed in perspiration. End of 2 hours, Houdini literally collapsed against the door, which opened. And it literally is a true story. It opened because the door, you see, had never been locked. And I just told you a big one. I said the door had never been locked. The door was firmly and thoroughly locked in Houdini's mind, which meant that it was locked as thoroughly as if every locksmith in the world had put their best locks on it. See, ladies and gentlemen, there are a lot of people who can stop you temporarily, but you are the only one who can do it on a permanent basis. In the course we teach in our schools, we teach a chapter even in high school on how to court after you're married. And we do that because we think you got to get along with people. We teach a great deal about how you get the most work and effective results out of other people. And it's simply by seeing the best in them. You want to reach your goals? The chances are 1,000 to 1. You're never going to make it by yourself. The mountain climber who climbs the high mountain, you see, has help in doing it. First of all, he's got the objective. Can you imagine Sir Edmund Hillary? The first man to scale Mount Everest, the tallest mountain in the whole world. Do you believe that he came down off that mountain and a reporter came up to him and said, "Sir Edmund, tell us, how did you climb the tallest mountain in the whole world?" "Do you really believe?" he said. "Well, I was just out walking around." No, I think you know that it didn't. I think you also know that he had to have some help. He had lots of it, and in life, that's the way it is. Have you ever watched the flock of Canadian geese flying over it? How many of you ever observed them? Two things you'll always notice about them. Number one, they're always in V formation. And number two, one leg of the V is always longer than the other one. Did you ever wonder why one leg was longer than the other one? It's simply because the long one, you see, has got more geese in it. Just wanted to see if I still had your attention. Okay, now, the purpose of the V is a very simple reason. You see, the lead goose in fighting the headwind creates a partial vacuum so that the geese on the right and the geese on the left fly in a partial vacuum, and so they periodically change leadership so that the lead goose does not get exhausted. But they've discovered in wind tunnel tests that the flock of geese can fly 72% further than the individual goose. When you go through life in cooperation with others, you can do so much more. I'm going to tell you a story, ladies and gentlemen, that I think says everything I want to say. A number of years ago, I met a man named Bernie Lovchik. He today has become as a brother to me. And this story is of his son, one of the most beautiful stories I think I've ever seen or heard. I tell the story in detail because it involves every principle in which I believe. Bernie told me about David. He said, "You know, Zig, when David was born, our family joy was complete because now we already had the two daughters. Now we've got the son." And we were just absolutely, tremendously grateful and excited. But he said it wasn't long before I noticed something was wrong. David's head hung too limply to the right side of his body. And he drew too much to be a normally healthy child, but the doctor said, "Don't worry about it, he'll outgrow it." But we knew better, so we took him to a specialist. Incredibly enough, the specialist diagnosed his condition as a reverse of club's feet and went to work on that condition. That went on for a few weeks, then they said, "We knew something more serious was wrong," so they took him to another specialist. And after a thorough examination, he said, "This little boy is a spastic. He has cerebral palsy. He's never going to be able to walk or talk or count to 10. I suggest that you put him in an institution for his own good and for the good of the, quote, normal members of the family." But Bernie Lovchik looked at me as he told the story and he said, "Zig, but I'm not a buyer, I'm a seller. I could not see consigning my son to the life of a vegetable." So we took him to another doctor and yet another and another and another until 30 doctors had all said, "There is no hope." Then we heard of a Dr. Perlstein down in Chicago. We finally got an alternate appointment with Dr. Perlstein because he was booked 2 years in advance. People came from all over the world to see Dr. Perlstein. But just 11 days later, a little boy from Australia canceled and they went down for their date with destiny. Dr. Perlstein examined this boy perhaps as no child has ever been examined before. And when he finished the examination, he looked at the Lovchiks and said, "This little boy is a spastic. He has cerebral palsy. He's never going to be able to walk or talk or count to 10 if you listen to the prophets of doom." But he said, "I want you to know that I am not problem conscious, I am solution conscious, and if you are willing to do your part, there is something that can be done for this little boy." The Lovchik said, "Doctor, name the price," and at that time they could not easily afford a heavy financial burden. The doctor and his nurse spelled it out in minute detail. They explained, "You're going to have to push this little boy beyond all human endurance. Then you got to push him more. You got to work him until he falls, and then you got to work some more. You've got to understand that there sometimes will be years when you'll be unable to take or notice any change at all. But if you ever stop, he goes all the way back. You got to understand that it's a forever commitment. You must never stop." One more thing. Don't ever let him see another victim of cerebral palsy taking therapy. Because if David sees the awkward, inadvertent movements of the other children, then he will emulate those instinctively. He will pick up their movements. The Lovchiks went home. They hired a physical therapist and a bodybuilder. They went to work, and it took them a lot of months, but David one day could move the length of his own body. Took him several years, but one day the therapist called Bernie home and said, "Come on home, I believe David is ready." Bernie rushed home, and there in the gymnasium on a mat, little David was getting ready to do a push-up. As that little body started to rise into the air, the emotional and physical exertion was so great that there wasn't a dry inch of skin on that little body, and the mat looked as if you had sprinkled water on it. When that one push-up was accomplished, mother and dad, the therapist, the sisters, the doctor, and everybody broke down and shed the tears that clearly say happiness is not pleasure, it's victory. And the story you see, ladies and gentlemen, is even more remarkable when you understand that one of America's leading universities had examined this little boy and said there are no motor connections to the right side of his body. He will never be able to swim or to skate or ride a bicycle. He'll have difficulty learning even to walk and stand straight. My wife and I had the privilege on October the 23rd, 1971, of flying to Winnipeg, Canada to attend the bar mitzvah of little David Lovchik. I wish you, sir, had had your TV cameras there that day. I wish the world could have seen what we had the privilege of seeing as we watched this little boy walk tall and straight and strong to the front of the synagogue to exchange and utter those vows that moved him into the manhood of the faith of his forefathers. Wish you could have seen this little boy whom the doctors had said would never be able to walk or talk or count to 10, who at that stage of his life had already done as many as 1,100 push-ups in a single day, who had run 6 miles nonstop, who in February 1974 qualified for an unrated $100,000 ordinary life insurance policy, who today is one of the top table tennis players in Western Canada, who shoots golf in the high 80s, who they say in 2 more years will be Mr. Manitoba, meaning simply that he has the most perfectly developed physical body in that entire province of Canada. How many times have I said to myself, as I've seen this boy from 2 to 10 times a year, how many times have I said, I wonder how much bigger, faster, stronger, smarter, how much more he would have been had he been given the opportunity of a normal birth as you and I. Then one day it hit me like a ton of bricks. Had he been given more, he undoubtedly would have ended up with less. I believe, ladies and gentlemen, that's the reason God tells us so clearly in His book to thank Him for everything. Because, you see, before it happens, it has already crossed His desk. I tell the story of David Lovchik because it says so many things of the things that I wish to speak of. I now conclude this evening by sharing what I think to you, or with you, what I really think is the story of America. And it says so much about the David Lovchik story itself. As a matter of curiosity, how many of you had noticed this chrome-plated pump sitting up here? That's very observant. I've noticed when I step aboard an aircraft with this pump, as a general rule, I'm the only passenger that's got one. I want to tell the story because it's the story of life. It's the story of America. It's your story. It's my story. A couple of good friends of mine down in Montgomery or Greenville, Alabama, named Bernard Haygood and Jimmy Glenn, out riding through the South Alabama foothills one day, and they got a little thirsty. Bernard was driving. He's the athletic one. He pulled behind this old abandoned farmhouse, saw this old pump over there, rushed over, grabbed the handle, and started to pump. How many of you have ever used one of these old pumps, okay? You'll know what I'm talking about. Well, old Bernard was pumping away for a few minutes, you know, and frankly, he said, "Jimmy, you better get that old bucket over there and come over here and dip some water out of the creek." He said, "We're going to have to prime the pump." How many of you know what I'm talking about when I say you got to prime the pump? Well, obviously, that just means you got to put something in here before you can get it out here. That's the story of life. See, so many people stand in front of the stove of life and they say, stove, now give me some heat, then I'll put some wood in you. So many times the secretary comes to the boss and says, give me a raise, then I'll start doing what you're paying me to do now. So many times the salesman says, make me the boss, make me the sales manager, and then I'll start performing. Oh, it's true, I haven't done anything yet, but you see, I got to be in charge. But the law says you got to put something in before you can expect to get anything out. You see, the farmer knows that before the seed's going to come up, before he can raise the crop, he's got to plant the seed. Well, it is hot. It is August. Old Bernard wanted that drink of water, but, you know, the question comes up, just how much are you willing to do to get a drink of water? And finally he said, you know, Jimmy, I don't believe it's in the water down there. Jimmy said, yeah, it is, Bernard. You know, in South Alabama, the wells are deep, and we're glad they are. Because, you see, the deeper the well, the cooler, the cleaner, the sweeter, the purer, the better tasting the water is. And Mr. Cooper, that's the story of life. Right there. The girl, you see, or the boy who make the good catches are not the ones who say yes to every Tom, Dick, and Harry or Mary, Sue, and Jane that come along. They do not let the passion of the moment get the better of the judgment which would destroy a lifetime. Because, you see, they understand that those things that are valuable, those things that are eternal, have value. And the value, you see, comes from the fact that we've got to do a little pumping in order to get it. Well, old Bernard wanted that drink of water. I mean, he was already sweating a mile a minute, you know, and he was determined up to a point to get that drink of water. And finally he just said, Jimmy, there just ain't no water down there. Jimmy said, don't stop, Bernard, don't stop. If you do, the water goes all the way back down, and then we're going to have to start all over. And isn't that the story of life? You see, you can't look at the outside of the pump and say, yeah, just two more strokes is all it needs. You can't look in the inside of a prospect's head and say, yep, just two more closes, that's all I need. You see, the water might be way down there, but this we know. If we pump long enough and hard enough and enthusiastically enough, that eventually the reward which always follows the effort will bring forth the reward. And then, of course, we know that once the water starts to flow, all you got to do is keep a little easy, steady pressure on it. And then you're going to get more water than you know what to do with. Have you ever noticed when things are good, they get better? When they're bad, they get worse? And it's got nothing to do with what's going on out there. It's got everything to do with what's going on in here. You know why I love the story of the pump? You see 10,000 people here today, but you don't know how they got here. You don't know all of the pumping and the blood and the sweat and the tears that have gone in all of the months and years of prior preparation and training and commitment and dedication of the principles that was involved. You see, I love the story of the pump because, you see, this is a story of life. It has nothing to do with whether you're black or white or male or female or Catholic or Jew or Protestant. It has nothing to do with whether you're old or young, fat or slim. It has everything to do with your God-given rights as free people to work as long as you wish, as hard as you wish, and as enthusiastically as you wish to get everything in life that you want. Believe in you. Believe in your fellow human being. Believe in the job that you have, the profession of which you're a part. Believe and know that America is the land of the free. It's the home of the brave. It's the land where any man or any woman can get anything they're willing to make a contribution for. And of infinitely more importance than anything any speaker will ever say in front of any group, believe in Almighty God. And if you do, I close not by wishing you a good day. I close by guaranteeing you a good forever. And I truly will see you at the top. God bless you. Thank you.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's presentation. Please feel free to give us a call at 877-202-8891. The vision of Grandy & Associates is quite simple. We teach companies how to run profitable businesses. For more information on how we do that, check out our website at www.grandyassociates.com or give us a call at 1-877-202-8891. Prophet University Audio Series is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line at 1-877-202-8891. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.